Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm from the Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Haley, and my bar number is 34384. I know we don't have a lot of time, and there's a couple of arguments in the brief that are fairly complicated, so I'm just going to dwell on two. And the first one I'm going to start off with is the sufficiency of the evidence on the first-degree assault. As this court knows, to be found guilty of first-degree assault, you have to have serious bodily injury, and it has to be with a deadly weapon. In this case, my argument is that there was no deadly weapon. His hands did not constitute a deadly weapon because they weren't used in the manner in which this court and the Colorado Supreme Court have found that hands can be used as a deadly weapon. It's distinguishable from those cases. And also, there was no serious bodily injury here. And what I mean by that is, the Attorney General is right that in my brief, I readily acknowledge that if you strangle someone, that very well could constitute serious bodily injury. But the issue in this case is we simply don't have enough evidence to reach to that level to regard it as serious bodily injury. And the reason we don't is because the expert witness who testified here did so in a very generic way. He said, first of all, you have to apply enough force to the neck. Secondly, it has to be applied long enough to the neck. And thirdly, this deprivation has to lead to a lack of oxygen in the brain, which can then, but not necessarily, will cause an oxybrain injury, which is serious bodily injury. In this case, the victim testified he choked her with both hands, and she had pain, difficulty breathing, and she urinated herself. But she never said she passed out. She never said she saw stars. If you look at the photographs, which I attached to the brief, you can show an exceedingly minor bruise on one part of her neck. It's not even to the level of what some might say a hickey is. It looks as if there was pressure applied to her neck, but it was done so in a very light and quick manner. And that's actually consistent with the victim's testimony. She says, he came in, he immediately grabbed my neck, and shortly thereafter, he took out a pocket knife and held it to my side, no longer using his hands to grasp her neck.
Pardon me for...
Stop.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
We're stepping all over each other today, Judge Bernard. Mr. Huff, wasn't there evidence that there was enough force to cause broken blood vessels in the victim's eyes? And what significance does that have in the sufficiency analysis?
Well, I think petechial hemorrhaging is definitely a factor in determining whether there was a sufficient amount of force, but it's certainly not dispositive. People can get petechial hemorrhaging, from what I understand, from relatively minor causes. One common example is if you go too far underwater, you can come up with petechial hemorrhaging, and that doesn't necessarily mean you were close to death. It just means that there was a sufficient amount of pressure. But in this case, the problem is they might have been able to prove that there was sufficient force and sufficient time in this case, but the problem is they didn't elicit enough testimony from the victim, and the testimony that they elicited from the expert witness was very vague and generalized. He said, in general, this is what happens. He never said, you know, based upon this particular case, given these particular facts, I deduce that she did not receive an ample amount of blood to her brain in this case, and therefore she was at risk for receiving an oxybrain injury. In fact, Weidman, the expert witness in this case, noted that it looked like the bruise on her neck came from a simple grasping. There were no ligature marks, there was no substantial bruising, which, according to Weidman, would almost necessarily precede a serious bodily injury form of strangulation.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Huff, if I may, please. When you combine the petechial hemorrhaging with the victim's testimony, don't you have at least this, that somewhere along the continuum, she was strangled hard enough that she lost control over her bladder? And isn't that a significant thing?
That could be a product of her simply being scared, though.
Well, I understand that, but we can speculate all day long about this stuff. The record said it says that she said that she was being strangled, she had trouble breathing, and she urinated.
Right. The problem is Weidman testified that what would necessarily precede an oxybrain injury would be loss of consciousness, perhaps even seeing stars. And she didn't describe any of that happening to her. And if you look at the photographs, it's very clear from the best evidence that we have, which are the photographs, that this was not a significant long-term severe strangulation case. We've probably all seen real strangulation cases where someone actually does end up losing consciousness or dies.
And those people don't necessarily have the sort of physical marks you're talking about.
Well, in my experience, they have, but I'm not going to disagree with the court on that point. My point is, Weidman said, first of all, he testified in very general terms. He didn't relate it close enough to the evidence at hand. And he basically said, before you have the threat of an oxybrain injury, you're going to lose consciousness. The fact that she has very minor bruising, she didn't lose consciousness, she said she didn't even see stars at this point, suggests that she wasn't even anywhere near close to receiving an oxybrain injury. When you combine that with her testimony from the cold record, that seems to suggest this happened very quickly. He strangled her for a few moments, a few seconds. She urinated herself, and then he went for the pocket knife, holding it to her side.
Let me ask you this. Our standard of review is to take the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution,
yes,
correct?
Sir.
Assuming that to be the case, why isn't the physician's answer to the question that the prosecutor posed that said, would this injury have a substantial risk of causing a protracted loss or impairment of the function of any part of her organ or her body? He answered yes. Why isn't that enough?
Because his whole testimony was premised upon a generic opinion of strangulation cases as opposed to the specifics of this one.
Wouldn't the jury be entitled to any part of the testimony they wanted to? So the equivocation that you're talking about, the jury could disregard that, couldn't it?
Well, the jury could disregard it, but when we're reviewing that on appeal, it definitely comes into play for sufficiency analysis, in my opinion. All the facts do. And yes, the jury is the ultimate judge of credibility, but I'm not even talking about credibility. I'm saying, given the victim's testimony 100% complete, you know, if you believe every word of it, the fact that she didn't testify about how much pressure was applied to her neck. She didn't testify about how long this pressure was applied to her neck. She basically said it was brief. At least that's my reading from the transcript. She didn't report feeling like she was going to pass out, seeing stars. And then the expert witness comes in and he speaks in very generic terms about strangulation injuries, but he never specifically relates it back to the testimony or lack of testimony, lack of evidence in this case with regard to these injuries. And in fact, everything from the expert seems to suggest this was, as he put it, a simple grasping of the neck as opposed to a full-on strangulation. If there are no other questions with regard to the sufficiency, I'll move on to my second issue that I'd like to bring up with the court, and that is the peremptory challenge issue. I think the Attorney General puts it correctly in her answer brief when she says on page 12, the trial court treated the acceptance of the panel by the defense as a waiver of his fourth peremptory challenge. As far as I know, this is an issue of first impression on appeal. I could not find any case that dealt with this issue in particular. But if I could sum this up as succinctly as I can, I would say where the trial court erroneously allows any party, the defense or the prosecution, to use a peremptory challenge against someone that they're not allowed to by statute, the remedy in that case is not to regard them as having waived a challenge. The remedy would be to try to start back from square one, seat that juror back in the box and say, no, you shouldn't have exercised it towards that person. You could only exercise it towards the person coming into the box. So we're going to reset the clock back to that point. In this case, the court regarded that error by everybody that allowed that to take place as a waiver of a peremptory challenge.
You're reading the record to indicate that the trial judge allowed defense counsel to exercise an improper challenge before this discussion occurred?
Well, I believe that's what happened because defense attorney accepted the panel. The prosecutor continued to use peremptory challenges. Instead of using a peremptory challenge against a new person that came in, the defense used one against someone who was already sitting in the box. So yes, the court's in charge of voir dire, the court's in charge of the procedures. We mistakenly or erroneously did that, but the court allowed it to happen.
Well, I thought the court's discussion, excuse me, my reading of the record was that the court had a discussion with counsel about whether there was a waiver or not well before the challenge to juror H, who was the one that had already been passed by both sides, accepted by both sides.
Right. The court, you're correct, Your Honor. The court did regard us as waiving a peremptory challenge when all we did was accept the panel.
But so I'm getting the inference that you seem to be making is that to rectify this waiver concern, the court allowed an improper challenge?
I'm not sure if the court allowed it, but it happened on the court's watch while the court was supervising. I don't think anybody intentionally wanted to violate the rule here. I don't think that the defense set out to intentionally violate the rule. I don't think that the court realized at that point that the rule was being violated. The point is the rule was violated, but the remedy for that is not to take away one of the defense peremptory challenges. The remedy would be to restart it from where the error happened and return the parties back to where they were originally with their peremptory challenges.
What was the error in this case? Could you describe for me what you're alleging as the error in this case?
Well, it's a violation of Crim P 24D4.
Right, but was the error, did the error occur before defense counsel improperly challenged a juror whom he'd already accepted? Or was that the error?
I reread the record today to try to clarify that in my own mind, and I could not see, the sequence of events was hard to divine from the record, but it appears that the error occurred when we passed the panel for cause, which was not an error. The prosecution then continued to exercise their peremptories, and we then used one of our peremptories to strike someone who was already in the box versus the person that we should have used that peremptory to, a new person coming in the box. But my point is that mistake on the defendant's part and the court for allowing it to happen shouldn't result in the forfeiture of a peremptory challenge by the defense.
Let's assume you're right that there should have been a seventh challenge.
Yes.
Available to the defendant. The problem that I'm having is that it appears, as you recognize, that defense counsel improperly struck a juror who had already been passed.
Yes, sir.
And so what assurance do we have that defense counsel would have used that seventh challenge against a person who was just a replacement juror that he could properly challenge?
Well, ideally, that record would have been made. It wasn't. However, like I said, the proper remedy in this place would have been to return the people back, to return the juror back to where he should have been and return the parties back to where they would have been. I agree, there's no way to know that. However, when the court regarded this as a waiver, the defense indicated that he would have exercised all of his peremptory challenges. perhaps he could have made a better record as to who exactly he would have exercised that towards. But the case law says, you know, to make the record, all you have to do is basically say you were going to exercise all of your peremptory challenges.
Isn't that in the context of where a challenge for cause was erroneously denied? Does that make a difference?
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Well, in most cases, the court's already erroneously denied a challenge for cause, thus taking something away from the defendant.
Right.
And so here, there's no challenge for cause at issue. It's just a number situation.
Right.
Is there any reason why that should be treated differently than the challenge for cause, or no?
I don't think so, because as long as the defense indicated that it would have exhausted all of its peremptories, I think we have to take the defense at its word. As an officer of the court, it was making a representation that they would have all been exhausted had the court not taken one of them away. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to begin by addressing the peremptory challenge issue that was raised. Here, what happened was the prosecutor had exercised its fourth peremptory challenge. At that point, defense counsel accepted the jury panel. The prosecutor then exercised his fifth challenge. A new juror was brought into the box. The defendant then used his fourth challenge on the new juror that was brought into the jury box. And again, that juror was replaced. The prosecutor again accepted the panel at that point. And the court then tells the defendant that he waived his fourth challenge, and therefore this next challenge would be his sixth challenge. At that point, there's a discussion. The defendant disagrees with the court, but he goes on and removes the juror that was brought into the box after the last challenge. At that point, the court tells the prosecutor that they are at their last challenge because they also waived a prior challenge. They again accept the jury. At this point, the court tells the defendant, this is your last challenge. And at this point, the defendant challenges a juror who was sitting in the box at the time that he previously accepted the jury. So that juror was not subject to a peremptory challenge at that point. And then that juror was subsequently replaced and jury selection ended. The defendant argues that he was entitled to another peremptory challenge. And I suppose that he's correct in that he was entitled to seven peremptory challenges, and his acceptance of the jury panel was not a waiver of one of those challenges. However, he's only entitled to that challenge to the extent that he was going to use that challenge on an acceptable juror, meaning a juror who was subsequently brought into the jury box after he accepted the jury panel. Here we have no information in the record regarding what juror the defendant intended to challenge with that seventh challenge. And in fact, the court asked the defendant directly if he would like to make a record and tell the court which juror he wanted to challenge, and the defendant declined. And based on the facts that we have in this case, we can't assume that the defendant was in fact going to challenge juror D, who was the juror that was subsequently brought into the box, because the facts indicate that he may have challenged someone who'd been previously seated in the box since he had already done that once. And he was aware at the time that he was making these challenges that the court had already limited the number of challenges that the court was going to allow. And it didn't challenge juror D when it had the opportunity. And when it challenged juror H, it knew that juror K was going to be seated in replace of juror H and that it would not have another challenge to use against that juror either. So in this case, without a record saying that, I would in fact have challenged juror D had I been given the opportunity. There's not any way to know that there is in fact reversible error here. There's no way to know that the defendant was denied any right to use his peremptory challenges because we don't have any assurances that he would have used them in an acceptable manner.
Ms. Jones, hasn't the Colorado Supreme Court in cases like Prater and McCrander resisted all arguments that the defense has to identify the juror that would have been stricken?
Yes, but I think this situation is very different. And I think that even if this were a numbers issue, as it is in a different case where the defendant had been making his challenges in accordance with the rules, we might be able to say, well, of course he was going to challenge juror D because that was the only one available and he was proceeding in that way. But here, where we have a situation where the defendant has challenged someone who he was not able to challenge, then I think that changes the fact scenario. And we also have a situation where the defendant was aware of the limited number placed on him, and he still didn't challenge that juror. So there's no indication that even if he had said, I want to challenge juror H, and the court had said, no, that juror is not subject to a challenge, we don't know that he then would have gone on and challenged juror D. He left juror D on the panel in place of juror H, so he may have liked juror D, and there may be no error at all here.
When was the error first brought to light that the defendant challenged a juror that wasn't available for challenge?
I don't think that was ever brought to light.
In the trial court?
In the trial court. No, there was no comment on that. So the first time that came up was on appeal. So again, I would just stress that without a sufficient record to know that the defendant was going to use his peremptory challenge on an acceptable juror, there can't be any reversible error in this case. If the court has no further questions on that issue, I would just like to address briefly the identification issue and focus on the harmless error argument.
Ms. Jones, would you, other than doing that, respond to the sufficiency issue? I think your briefs are very adequate on both sides on the identification issue. We understand that very well.
Well, again, I think that when we're reviewing sufficiency of the evidence, the court has to give, the evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution. The prosecution gets the benefit of every reasonable inference that might be drawn from the evidence presented. And here we have the testimony from the expert as well as the testimony from the victim, who testified that the defendant was strangling her, that she thought she was going to die, that she lost control of her bladder. There was hemorrhaging to her eyes. I think the jury can take all of that information and make a decision. Certainly, it's a jury question. I mean, it's a question of fact, and this is why we have the jury to make this decision. But certainly the evidence rises to a level that it was sufficient for the jury to find that there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt of serious bodily injury in this case.
Standard says substantial and sufficient, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So as I understand the defense's argument, it is that, well, it's not substantial. What you have here is you have a victim who didn't testify enough, perhaps because of a language barrier, or perhaps because the prosecution simply didn't prepare it well enough to get the information out there. How do you respond to that?
I think that the victim did testify enough in this case. Certainly, it's always nice if we could have more evidence, but what we have here is certainly enough to satisfy the burden and to reach the standard here. The victim testified that the defendant strangled her up against a wall and on the bed. She testified, well, she didn't specify exactly how much pressure he exerted. She did testify that she thought she was going to die. So the amount of pressure was enough, it was substantial enough that she thought she was going to die. So this isn't a simple grasping. While that term was certainly used, I think that the victim would describe it much differently than that, and I think that she in fact did describe it differently than that.
Well, except the standard, the statutory language doesn't talk about fear of death as an element of serious bodily injury.
It talks about risk of death.
Substantial risk of death.
Yes, which we have with strangulation. We also have impairment of functions of the body, and we have protracted loss or impairment of any function or part of the body. We have substantial risk of death. And I think we have that in a case where you have strangulation, and we have expert testimony talking about the things that indicate that this was a strangulation. We have the hemorrhaging, we have the urination, we have the victim's testimony here that she thought she was going to die, that this was not a simple grasping, that this was extreme. And I think the jury can draw the reasonable inference from that testimony and determine that serious bodily injury occurred in this case.
If you don't mind, Ms. Jones, I'd like to go back to the peremptory challenge issue, if I may, please. Is that okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Of course.
Thank you. I am interested in Judge Boris's question about the absence of a challenge for cause problem here. Nonetheless, in cases like McCrander, our Supreme Court has told us that The problem here is when a defendant doesn't have all of his or her challenges and thus isn't able to do what he or she can to shape the jury that determines the ultimate issue. Here, that was clearly the case. The defendant was entitled to 7. He only got 6. And we also know, at least under the status of the law now, that we don't apply a harmless error analysis here. So can you distinguish this case from McCrander sufficiently to pull it out from that umbrella? Or, as I may suggest, is it still enough under the umbrella to be problematic?
Well, I think that the distinction here, Your Honor, is that while the defendant was entitled to 7 peremptory challenges, he was only entitled to those 7 challenges to the extent that he used them within the confines of the rule. And the rule requires that those challenges, once he has passed the jury for cause, may only be used on jurors who are subsequently brought into the jury box. So to the extent that he does not wish to exercise further challenges on those jurors, he's not entitled to those 7 challenges to use on any juror that he wishes. He is confined to using those challenges on the jurors subsequently brought into the box. And because we don't know how he would have used this challenge had he received it, we can't be sure that he was in fact denied any of his rights regarding the peremptory challenges. Does that sufficiently answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Does the statute say anything about the manner of exercising, or is that just a rule?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Does the statute have provisions that overlap Rule 24 about how the challenges are, how the peremptory challenges are supposed to be used?
I believe it's just the rule that talks about how the challenges alternate between the prosecution and defense.
So if that rule is violated, is there any violation of the statute that's shown?
But there wasn't any violation of the statute regarding how the challenges were used. I mean, they did still alternate the challenges. The prosecution went, then the defendant went. It was just the way in which the court calculated the challenges based on the defendant's waiver.
Right, but if the statute provides for a certain number and the defendant didn't get that number, you're trying to say that he's only entitled to exercise those challenges on appropriate jurors, but that appropriate juror piece of it seems to be provided by the rule and not the statute. Is that right?
Yes, and then I guess it would be a determination of whether this was procedural or substantive to determine whether the rule versus the statute controlled in this case. At the same time, I don't think the two don't really conflict because there's nothing in the statute about how this is done, so I'm not sure it's a case of one over the other. I think they can be read jointly in this case, and then you would apply the provisions that are provided by the rule. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that this court affirm.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.